I have to tell you, I am so happy to be in Steamboat Springs. You don't know how happy. Steamboat Springs has been part of my family's narrative for over half a century. In fact, my mother's life, going back to the 1930s. My mother was an extraordinary woman who learned to fly a plane at the age of 14. In the old days of the sharecroppers. She acted until her death at the age of 91. And it all started at Perry Mansfield. So I had a wonderful time this afternoon when Kate and Malcolm Hawk took me to see Perry Mansfield. So I've come full cycle. I want to do something a little bit unusual today. I want to narrate what I'm talking about with some pictures. I'm a great believer that a picture is really worth 1,000 words, and what we're seeing for the United States and for the Middle East and the entire Islamic world is really an extraordinary turning point. So if we could turn the lights off on me and give you focus on my pictures, let me begin. The most important story in the early 21st century is the epic convulsion across the Middle East. Rage and rebellions against autocratic leaders is the greatest wave of empowerment since the historic spurt of uprisings that we saw in Eastern Europe against communism, in the challenge to apartheid and minority rule in Africa, and in the challenge to military dictatorships in Latin America. The Arab revolts in Egypt, in Tunisia, and beyond now constitute one of the four most important turning points of the last century in this region. And they are only the opening act of what is likely to be a very long, turbulent, and yet hopeful transition. This is the scene just from last week in the second round of the revolution in Egypt. The current Arab uprisings are on a par with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire at the end of World War II, which created a whole new set of states, the modern Arab entities, and redefined borders. It's on a par with the creation of Israel after the end of World War II, which redefined security issues and reshaped alliances for the United States. And the third was the 1979 Iranian Revolution, which redefined the world's political spectrum and introduced Islam as a modern political idiom. The new movements are also redefining who is empowered, not just in the Middle East, which constitutes 22 Arab countries, but across the 57 nations of the Islamic world. The day of elites and the many who were part of our alliances is passing. There is a whole new generation emerging. It's a young generation. The unrest across the region erupted for several reasons, but most notably because two-thirds of the 300 million people in the Arab world are under the age of 30. This is a young woman in Dara, who is protesting about Dara, which is the site where the Syrian uprising began, when 13 and 14-year-olds wrote anti-government slogans on government buildings. And when they were arrested, that ignited an uprising that flares on more than 4 months later. This is also the first generation where the majority are literate, where they think about issues beyond daily subsistence, when they believe they have, for the first time in thousands of years, some control over their destiny, some say in what they do. And importantly, where females are as much a part of the picture as the men. This is the first time that the majority of women and men are now literate, which has contributed enormously in their sense of not only what they want to do with their lives, but their sense of the outside world. People now have developed a voice. And they are willing to use it very bluntly, whether in the old media, like graffiti, or the new media. This was one of the banners at Cairo's Tahrir Square. One father in Egypt actually named his daughter Facebook in honor of the uprising. And these, of course, are all the symbols of the new technology. Now, I have covered wars in the Middle East since 1973. I landed by accident in the region for the first time on October 6, 1973, which was the day the fourth Middle East war broke out. I have covered all six wars since then, both of the Palestinian intifadas as well as assorted other revolutions and turning points. And the thing that has struck me the most about the uprisings in vastly different political systems, in military dictatorships like Libya and monarchies in the Gulf, in homogeneous societies as well as deeply sectarian countries, in modern states as well as in traditional tribal societies, in pitifully poor nations, as well as in oil-rich sheikdoms, the overwhelming means of challenging regimes in the world's most volatile region is peaceful civil disobedience. This is a change that is of profound consequence in terms of our long-term interests, in terms of the conflicts that have beset that region for so long. What is also striking is the desperate nature of the regimes and the extremes they are willing to go to, the bloody extremes, in putting down their own protests, as in Bahrain. Attacking peaceful encampments. This is one in Bahrain where there were hundreds of tents that were camping around the clock as well. And the government, the monarchy, went after the protesters at Pearl Square. Now, Bahrain, Pearl Square, and this monument are tremendously important. Bahrain had pearls, pearl divers, long before it had oil. This monument is like its Eiffel Tower. It's, you know, I'm trying to think of what it is for us, but it is the monument. It's on the country's most valuable coin. But the regime was so desperate to put down the uprising that had centered around Pearl Square and the Pearl Monument that it tore down Pearl Monument to make sure that there was nothing around which to mobilize. These are the four men whose future has either been determined, the presidents of Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, and Yemen. I don't know why I don't have Yemen there. Two of them are gone, Mubarak and President Ben Ali in Tunisia, Mubarak of Egypt. And the other two cannot survive politically. It may take a long time for them to actually leave office, but politically it's untenable for them to survive. My father, who is also a great character, he was a law professor, but he bet on everything. Politics, sports, never bet more than a quarter. But I would bet 50 cents that both of the other two leaders will be out by the end of the year. All 22 Arab countries will be changed significantly because of the rebellions across the region. And all 22 leaders will have their powers changed in some significant way, even if the majority of them manage to stay in office for now, with the emphasis on for now. But the bold challenges against the regimes are only one part of the story. The other half is the challenge to extremism. The common message of the uprisings is a rejection of militancy in all its forms. I call it the counter-jihad. This is a picture from the last tape, most recent tape, by Ayman al-Zawahiri, who is the successor to Osama bin Laden. It was sent, it was an audio tape, and it was sent with a still picture to stations throughout the region. It was sent before, during the protest, before Mubarak was ousted, but it did not arrive until afterwards. The tape rambled on for 45 minutes about 19th and 20th century Ottoman history. It railed against democracy. And the thing that was most striking about it in this day of warp speed Twitter and Facebook communications that transmit messages in lightning speed is that Al-Qaeda is really behind the curve. It doesn't understand the political realities. It doesn't understand the tools of technology that have transformed and empowered people and the way that in the process people have turned against extremists. Al-Qaeda, and as we've seen, bin Laden now gone, increasingly look like the losers they are. One of the trends I write about in my new book is what I call the big chill, the decision by clerics who were once allied with bin Laden or Al-Qaeda or were mentors to the movement to repudiate its activities, its tactics, and its targets. This is Sheikh Salman al-Odeh, who is a Saudi cleric. He was the first role model for Osama bin Laden. He was the one who issued a fatwa during the 1990-91 Gulf War when the U.S. deployed troops in Saudi Arabia. And Sheikh Salman, as he's known, issued a fatwa against the Saudi government for allowing foreigners into the land of Islam's holiest places and issued a fatwa against the United States. The Saudi government then arrested Sheikh Salman, and it was at that moment that bin Laden began calling himself an emir, a sheikh, and began issuing fatwas in Sheikh Salman's absence. What's been captivating about the last few years, and Sheikh Salman has been freed by the Saudi government, is that he has now turned against Al-Qaeda, and every year on the anniversary of 9/11, he has gone on television, issued fatwas renouncing bin Laden, renouncing violence, and condemning the acts of 9/11 and all subsequent Al-Qaeda attacks. It's a real turning point. Dr. Fadl, that's his war name, his real name is Saeed Imam al-Sharif, is another cleric who's turned against bin Laden. He actually merged forces, he's an Egyptian, with bin Laden in the late 1980s. He wrote the first how-to book on jihad for Al-Qaeda in the mid-1990s. He was with bin Laden in exile in Sudan and then went with him to Afghanistan. His second book, which was over 1,000 pages, and mercifully I'll tell you, mine is only 250. His second book was has often been called the Das Kapital of Al-Qaeda. In it, he condoned killing anyone in any religion, including Islam, who disagreed with Al-Qaeda, simply for the act of disagreeing. But he subsequently fell out with bin Laden and abandoned Al-Qaeda, and he has since issued a third book in which he calls 9/11 a catastrophe and condemns the use of violence, talks about Christians and Jews as people of the same religious tradition. This, again, is a dramatic change. In the place of the extremists, or what I call the rise of the satellite sheikhs and the YouTube imams, who are street sheikhs, who are not schooled in theology, but they have television programs throughout the region that have religious messages. Shugerry is a New Age preacher who has even given sermons on Elvis Presley. He has a show that's very popular across the region. It started as 5 minutes, grew every year until it became the most popular program on 500 of the 500 satellite channels now in Arabic. It's an extraordinary thing what's happened in the region. In 1996, Al Jazeera was born, one satellite channel circumventing state government control of the media, and today there are over 500 channels. His is the most popular program on Al Arabiya, and in it it's called What Would He Have Done? And it's a candid camera type program where he will, for example, leave a wallet on the floor or leave some garbage. And he films what people do as they see the wallet or see the garbage. And then he comes from behind his hiding place and says, what would he have done? And the he, of course, is the Prophet Muhammad. And the idea is to try to teach positive religious values. And again, a very different message than the kind of extremist clerics we've witnessed in the region over the past three decades. The other thing I write about in the book is what I call the new martyrdom. The first uprising in the Middle East was started by this young man. His name is Mohamed Bouazizi. And on December 17th, in a remote Tunisian village, an inspector went up and demanded that he pay a bribe. He sold fruit on the street on a wooden cart. And this is a common practice. The entire Arab uprising began over a $7 bribe that he refused finally to pay after paying it many times because $7 was often more than he earned in a whole day. The inspector then took his produce and his electronic scale. He tried to go from government office to seek recourse. He was rebuffed at every government office, and so he then went to the city where he lives. Sidi Bouzid is the head of one of the states, capital of one of the states. So he went to the governor's office, and he poured paint thinner over his body, and he set himself on fire. Tunisia's so-called Jasmine Revolution, which is named after the national flower, marked a turning point as important for Islam as important for politics. Bouazizi set himself on fire and became a martyr, not to hurt or kill anyone else, but to shame a government at his own expense. In the end, his new kind of martyrdom was far more effective than any of the acts of militancy over the past three decades. Bouazizi actually lingered for 3 weeks. And this is a picture of President Ben Ali in a desperate bid to hold on to power, visiting him in his hospital room. He was burned over 90% of his body. He died in January, and a week later, President Ben Ali fled to Saudi Arabia. After the president left and after his death, thousands drove in a convoy to this remote Tunisian town to pay homage at the grave of Mohamed Bouazizi. And today there is a national stamp in his honor. Khalid Said is another of the new martyrs. He was in Egypt. Late last summer, he was in an internet cafe in Alexandria. Two policemen walked in because they believed he was trying to load pictures that he had obtained of police taking a bribe and doing deals over drugs. And so they took him out on the street and they beat him. And the last thing he was heard saying was, "You're killing me." But the police felt that he was challenging the regime in a way that would hurt it. Now, I'll warn you, the next picture is really tough, and you may not want to take a look at it. But the picture of Khalid Said in the morgue then circulated and was a rallying cry that initiated protests. The government said he died of swallowing drugs. That is not the picture of a man who died from a drug overdose. He was clearly beaten to death. People then started taking to the streets of Alexandria and Cairo and beyond, and having the two pictures of Khalid Said before and Khalid Said after. And the momentum picked up throughout the summer and the fall. Every once a week, people turned out on the streets. And it was after the Tunisian uprising that the Egyptians realized that they could make a difference. And on January 25th of this year, that's where the name January 25th movement came from. They came out in honor of Khalid Said, knowing that the Tunisians had succeeded, and that was what turned the Egyptian population in large enough numbers to force in 18 days a man who had ruled for 30 years. In Syria, there's another martyr, 13-year-old Hamza al-Khatib. He was separated from his parents on April 29th this year in a protest in Daraa, the place where it all began. His parents heard nothing despite desperately going to government outlets to try to find out what had happened to him. Had he been imprisoned? Was he in the hospital? Had he wandered home someplace and gotten lost? A month later, in May this year, his body was returned to the family. And this is another tough picture if you want to look away. His body had 3 gunshot wounds. It was covered with cigarette burns, and his genitals had been cut off. A 13-year-old boy. Photos of his body ran on media throughout the region, proving the rumors of what happened to people detained in Syria. But rather than discourage Syrians, which is what the government intended, it instead increased the protests against the regime. His face became the symbol of the Syrian uprising, in part because he was just one of hundreds of children who had been arrested, imprisoned, tortured, and died just for engaging in civil disobedience. Now, I don't want to depress you completely because there are actually a lot of wonderful news, and half of my book is devoted to what I call the culture of change, which is in many ways as important and even more important than the politics because it reflects just how deep the change goes throughout the region. This is a young rapper. I have a whole chapter on hip-hop Islam. Rap is today the rhythm of resistance, and El General was as important to Tunisia's uprising as Mohamed Bouazizi, the first young martyr, was, because a month before the uprising, he wrote lyrics for a song against the regime in a country where politicians had not dared criticize President Ben Ali, who had ruled for almost a quarter century. But he dared not only to write it, but to put it out on his Facebook page. Rap or hip-hop was banned in Tunisia. They couldn't get permits to perform, they couldn't get contracts to record, couldn't get permission to appear on any of the largely state-controlled media. So he put it on his Facebook page. 20% of Tunisians were on Facebook. And this song, and these are some of the lyrics, were very bold in challenging bluntly the regime over issues of people starving and eating garbage, of the poverty that was prevailing, the unemployment among youth in the region that has the largest unemployment among young people in the world, proportionately. And so it was his song that was sung during the uprising in Tunisia and then spread to Egypt and Bahrain and beyond. His lyrics became literally the voice, the song of the uprising. This is a young Palestinian group. The thing that's important about this Palestinian group is that while they're still angry at Israel, They are an alternative to Molotov cocktails and rockets and suicide bombs. They express it in words. And they actually reach out to people of other faiths. And they have performed with Your altitude is going to get me. They've actually performed with Israeli rappers and in Israeli clubs. There's a wonderful documentary that's made about them called Slingshot Hip Hop. And I saw the premiere of it in Washington, D.C. They came and performed afterward at the Hard Rock Cafe a few blocks from the White House. And there were kids who were Muslim, Christian, and Jewish, rocking out with these kids. It was really extraordinary to see this cross-cultural connection through music. This is a young Saudi rapper in a country where popular music is banned and where the only form of dancing allowed is sword dancing among men in slow motion. A young rapper who is, again, through his words, challenging autocracy and challenging extremists as well. Arabian Nights is an Egyptian group. One of my favorite groups is Iran's Kiosk, which means nobody. During the 2009 presidential election in Iran, rap again was critical to the campaign. A septuagenarian cleric running for the presidency understood that hip-hop was so important in reaching young voters in a country where the majority, again, are under 30, that he distributed thousands of CDs with rap lyrics on them that were pro-democracy and calling for people to vote for him. He was one of those in the opposition who lost. These are some of the words of Kiosk. Immoral zealots, fanatic factions, Chinese-style economic expansions, smuggling women to Dubai, our noblemen turning a blind eye, foreign currencies all reserved, border movements all observed, counterfeit medication, addiction as recreation. Again, the irreverence, the idea of challenging a regime through music is quite extraordinary. Rap extends throughout the Islamic world, not just the Middle East. Kanaan is the voice of the Somali people. He, more than any, the United Nations speaks out more loudly on Somalia than any other entity or person. But after the UN, Kanaan is the voice, again, against piracy, against extremists, Al-Shabaab, the group that we're hearing more and more about in Somalia, in challenging the extremists. Now, one of the things we have to make sure of is that we don't misunderstand that even as people turn to Western idioms to express themselves, they are not necessarily trying to imitate us, adopt all Western ideas. This is a group called Mecca to Medina, the two holiest places in Islam. One of the things that has been striking to me is that in many of the lyrics, they talk about Islam, the proud and peaceful traditions of Islam. They're not backing the extremists, but we have to understand that this is not something that is necessarily going to imitate, whether it's the hip-hop in the West or the political systems in the West. One of my favorite groups is... rappers is a young American Muslim woman who calls herself Ms. Understood. They have lots of great names. Kate, do you have my book? I have one thing I want to tell you about from the book, and I forgot to get it. Another thing I write about it in terms of the trends of the region is what I call the pink hijab. Hijab is the conservative dress that women wear in some of the region, in some parts of the region. Gone are the days of black. Gone are the days of conformity, of austerity. The pink hijab, expressing yourself in a fashionable way but still being Muslim, reflects one of the important trends. This is Dalia Ziada, a young Egyptian. Again, she is educated. She is a blogger. She is an activist. She is committed to change, and yet she is conservative. Thank you. Dalia is a reflection of the kind of why the young have gotten involved, how long this has actually been coming, why this should not have been a surprise. Dalia first became an activist, as she likes to tell me, at the age of 8, when her mother told her to put on her best dress because they were going for a special commemoration. It was her circumcision. It was so painful to her, and it was so traumatic, that she decided she wanted to work within her family to convince her father and her uncles to protect her sister and cousins. Time and time and time again, she failed, until with her last cousin, she stayed up with her uncle all night arguing that he couldn't do this to her, that this would affect her for the rest of her life. And she said, if you do this to her, I'm going to cut off her finger. And he said to her, why would you do this? That will affect her for the rest of her life. And she said, duh. And she thought she'd failed again, but she convinced him. And she decided then, by then a teenager, that if she could affect one person's life, that maybe she could affect others. And she started looking around for other ways to try to argue with people about a different way. And she went to a lecture in which Martin Luther King was mentioned. And so she looked at ways to pick up King's message. And she found out about a comic book in English called The Montgomery Story, which told the story of the walk to freedom in Montgomery. And she translated this comic book into Arabic. In the back of the comic book were instructions on civil disobedience, and she translated them too. And she distributed to young friends and other bloggers from Morocco to Yemen. She then decided that she wanted to go further, and she organized the first human rights film festival in the Arab world. She came up with some films and decided that when she couldn't get permits, that she was not going to let the government stop her. So she went to the censorship board, waited at the elevator for the director, and rode up with him, arguing her case. He finally said, okay, I'll give you a permit. Then, of course, the theater where she wanted to show the films were blocked. It had its permit revoked. And so she decided that that she was not going to let the government stand in her way, so she went down and with some friends, they all put their money together and rented a Nile riverboat cruiser for tourists. And everybody showed up, got on the riverboat, and just as it took off from the dock, she showed the first film. And this she did all before the age of 27, all on her own steam. She's very kind of lower middle class, educated, activist, very committed. These are the kids who are turning out in Tahrir Square and changing. These are the new elites, replacing the ones that we have been so familiar with over the years. One of the things that has been in her, she has continued to do her film festival, and she's encouraged young filmmakers to make films about the regime, and she's been responsible for, in one film, it was just 1 minute long, and it had pictures of flowers just budding, and someone went through and clipped one after another, very, very, very quickly. And in the background, you heard the cry of a young girl or a female child, and of course, this was all about female genital mutilation. And so she has helped not only give voice to human rights issues, educate people on human rights, but she's encouraged filmmakers now to go out and create messages about very basic issues. Now, this is reflects the change that's happening. This is Hanan Turk, a very famous Egyptian actress who was known for her risque roles and her décolletage. She put on hijab, as many women in Egypt are, but she wants to do it in a fashionable way. 40 years ago, almost no Egyptian women wore hijab. Today, over 80% of them do. But it's not because they are fanatic or want Islamic states. It's an issue of identity. They want to be very fashionable. These are pictures of what they call the Spanish wrap, which is named after the flamingo dancer and has a big bun at the back, like the flamingos. One of the other trends I write about is the new role models that are being created. The 99 are a new series of comic book superheroes that were crafted by a Kuwaiti psychologist because he didn't want his sons to look at bin Laden and the other extremist groups as role models. He wanted a positive image. So he created the 99, who are 99 heroes, half male but half female. I never ask him who was the odd person, a male or female. And half the females wear hijab and half of them don't. But you can see that the ones who are not wearing hijab are quite contemporary in their appearance. He chose the 99 because in Islam, God has 99 attributes, charity and strength and wisdom and so forth. And each one of the characters has one of those 99 values. And their nemesis, of course, is a man modeled on bin Laden who wants to consolidate all 99 powers himself. And the comic books play out in the saga of how each one of the 99 struggles to retain their value and help society against the 99. And again, he's worked with Marvel Comics, and he has made such an impact that they have plans now for 6 parks modeled on Disneyland throughout the Persian Gulf, the most conservative corner of the Islamic world, and the first one has opened already in Kuwait, all based on the 99. One of the other trends I write about is the new Muslim comedians. This is a trio called Allah Made Me Funny. And they are from 3. One is from India, one is Palestinian, and one is an American Muslim. And they tell very political jokes against extremism as well as autocracy. They are using, again, a public voice like the rappers in creating a message. And I went and talked to dozens of them, and they all had similar stories how 9/11 was a critical moment when they realized that people, if they came out and said, I'm against extremism or whatever, people wouldn't believe them. But if they got out and told jokes about it, that they had much greater credibility. One of the other groups is called the Axis of Evil Comedy Tour. And these are, again, 4. They come from 4 different countries. And they are a wonderful. Many of them were born in Muslim countries, came to the United States, learned stand-up, and are now taking Islam back to the region. I want to tell you one joke from the book by an Iranian-born comedian named Maz Jobrani, because it will surprise you, and I'll warn you, it's a little bit dirty. He gets up on stage and he says, you know, one guy can really ruin it for the rest of us. Look at this Christmas Day bomber, the guy who tried to blow up the flight from Amsterdam to Detroit, this Abu Mustafa Bubu, or whatever his name is. I say this guy was crazy. Any man would back me on this. After all, where was the bomb? Yeah, right, in his underwear. I mean, really, any normal man would surely have questioned that instruction. Then he pretends that he is the hijacker with the bomb in his underwear, having his final conversation with his terror master. Excuse me, I have one last question for you. You say my reward in heaven is going to be 72 virgins. So do you think we might put the bomb someplace else? I mean, I really think I'm going to need my penis. Not exactly the humor you might anticipate. Dean Obadallah is of Palestinian descent, and his mother is actually Sicilian Catholic. His father is Palestinian Muslim. And he has very funny stories about how his mother once insisted that his father go to Mass with her. And afterwards, the family asked what the father thought of Mass, and he said, "Too salty." But he has been very important in taking stand-up back to the region, in teaching skepticism, open questioning, ridiculing governments, and has had an extraordinary impact. Every year they do an Arabs Gone Wild symposium, the Steamboat Springs Seminar of Jordan, in which they teach them about comedy and how to use it. And now there are, would you believe, Bassem Youssef is the John Stewart of Egypt. And he now has a program. It's only on the internet, but it's incredibly popular. And he does his fake anchor with his fake reporters. And during the uprising, he did a wonderful skit about a famous Egyptian actress complaining publicly that she couldn't get pizza home delivered during the uprising because of the inconsiderate chaos of the protesters. I'm going too fast. I don't know how to go back. Anyway, there's also another one called who calls himself the Jerry Seinfeld of Saudi Arabia. Jerry Seinfeld of Saudi Arabia? We're taking leaps and bounds here through comedy. Another of my favorite stories is about the new Muslim playwrights who are all using jihad in their titles. This is Jihad Jones and the Kalashnikov Babes. And it's a wonderfully raucous satire. This is the poster. I read it on the quiet car between New York and Washington, and I had all these dirty looks because I was laughing so loudly. Yusuf El-Gwindi is the playwright, and he, in a series of plays, has done parodies of Muslim extremists. He has challenged the idea of what jihad is, as they all are, trying to rescue the idea of jihad from extremists. Another of my favorite plays is called Tell Jihad Do Us Part, which, believe it or not, is a romantic comedy. And it's about a dysfunctional marriage. Again, the idea of rescuing jihad, which is about the ordinary struggles of everyday life to be good, whether it's in marriage or friendship or in your profession. One of the most moving stories is A Jihad for Love, which is a documentary by an Indian Muslim about the struggle to remain faithful to their religious beliefs in countries that are very strict, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iran. He went to all of these countries and interviewed people throughout it. You can actually get it on Netflix. But these are all young people who are gay or lesbian. And they don't want to abandon their faith. They want to stay true to it, but they also want to be honest about their gender identity. The central message in all of these is, again, that jihad today, for most Muslims, is not about killing Westerners or revenge against the United States, but about struggling with the issues of everyday life, which is what jihad literally is about. Now, I want in my last little bit to address the issue, what's next? There are great fears about, are we headed for more autocracies rather than democracies? More theocracies or democracies as we felt autocracies. People often ask me, how do I know these things? Why, aren't I going out on a limb? And I was relieved last week to find that a think tank in Washington had just released a new study of Tunisia and what the political trends were. And it proved, and so I want to show you just a tiny few slides to show you what public opinion is in this region. Even though there is growing frustration about the slow pace of change, 86% of Tunisians today are still very excited about getting out and voting in a free and fair election for the first time. For all the challenges they face in trying to craft transitions, in trying to afford transitions in countries that are all poor, people are still excited about the idea of democracy. The interesting thing is, as we in the West focus on who are they going to vote for, are they going to vote for Islamic parties, this is fascinating. 72% of people still are not sure. The largest party, which is the fourth from the Islamic party, fourth from the bottom, only gets 7%. Two above that is the leader of the Islamic party. He only gets 2%. Our fears, yes, there will be Islamic parties that do well. The Muslim Brotherhood was the largest opposition in parliament under Hosni Mubarak. They get 20 to 30%. But people are looking for other alternatives as well. Their minds are still open. This is an important one in understanding what kind of system do they want. I talk a lot about how, in my book, about how the next decade is going to be about kind of rival trends, the push for more democracy, but also to do it in an Islamic context, one that is comfortable in terms of legitimacy and defining goals. It's interesting here that 54% want a secular government. That's the majority of people in Tunisia. 40% are not as enthusiastic, but the majority are. And yet, over 80% favor some parties that have moderately or strongly Islamic values in them. Again, this what seems like contradictory trends. They are often going to be hard for us in the West, so fearful in the decade after 9/11, to fully fathom, because we are so afraid of of things that are politically Islamic. Why do you approve of a secular government? Almost half, because it is the way to guarantee freedom, democracy, and equality. And the last slide, which is interesting, is that Tunisians are toying with the idea of having a 50% quota for women in the national parliament. That would be higher than any country on earth. 53% say it's too high, but 41% say it's not too high. And frankly, I'm not sure it'd be that high in the United States. So it's actually, you know, for a society in which women are only now getting educations, are part of the mainstream, this is an important statistic. Let me close and move to your questions by making just a couple final points. For people in the region and for us, the next decade is going to be a time of unprecedented transformation as a new generation emerges. These are people we don't know, we're not on the American Embassy Rolodex, and who are going to be redefining politics and society and culture. The new generation will also face tougher challenges over the next generation than they did over the past generation. And we're likely, unfortunately, not to provide the resources at a time they're needed more than ever because of unemployment, because democracy is expensive, to be able to provide them. We are willing to commit in fighting terrorism, but we're not as generous when it comes to supporting democracy. It's a reality. Our aid to Egypt, even after the ouster of Hosni Mubarak, is still just as much to the military and just as little to civil society as it was during Mubarak's rule. The next generation, as I said, is likely to be more democratic and people demanding greater participation. but also you will see more women wearing hijab, which will be confusing. What I like to do is try to compare it to a tornado. When there's a tornado, people go to the basement and they cling to the pillars. It is the same for Muslims going through a political tornado. They cling to the pillars of identity that will give them some sense of values as they're moving through this period, but then they come up and rebuild. We shouldn't make the mistake of assuming that every society is going to be an Islamic republic. Iran is no longer a model for anyone in the Islamic world. And the thing we have to remember is that they're no longer turning to the AK-47 rifle and to the suicide bomb. They're looking at the modern tools of civil disobedience. But they're also holding us to account, and they expect more from us. This is going to be the great challenge as we try to figure out how do we respond, how do we help these people, but not race in and try to tell them, we know how to do this, we can help you, this is how you need to act. We're sometimes going to have to take a very deep breath and say, they need to learn from their own mistakes. This has to be a process that is credible and legitimate and in their own terms. We also need, I think, and this is one thing as we approach the 10th anniversary of 9/11, is to get over our own kind of Islamophobia. I had a research assistant who helped me with my book, whose father was Jewish and her mother was Christian. And she was very interested in understanding Islam, just as an academic subject. And she was at the University of Connecticut. She'd also grown up in stores. And she decided with an Egyptian friend that she would spend a day wearing hijab on campus to see what the public reaction was. And she went to all the places that she, you know, Starbucks in the morning, and she walked across the campus grounds during the day to her classes and so forth, and she wore a scarf. And she said what struck her so much as a person of two faiths on both sides of her parents was that appearing as a Muslim, no one would look her in the eye. And I thought it was very telling, and it was transformative in her life. So let me close by saying we can never underestimate people power these days. This is really one of the most inspiring periods of my life. And I have witnessed change all over the world. I was in the East Bloc for the fall of communism. I watched Nelson Mandela walk to freedom, and I covered, you know, Venezuela as in the early days as Latin America's first democracy. Transitions take a long time. In the Soviet Union, a generation after the fall of communism, you still have a former communist and KGB chief in power. In South Africa, the majority of blacks, economically and for some politically, are worse off today than they were under apartheid. They're sad truths. Change takes a long time. But my bottom line message is, this is the beginning of the beginning, but it is a beginning. And that's what we need to realize. I thank you very much, and I really look forward to your questions.